Hello, this is Chris with the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, June 17th. We begin today's reading on the front page, A Tragic Miracle. Her partner's sudden death gave Rantoul woman a new lease on life, bound her forever to him, from Champaign. For Casey Fisher, James Wood Jr. was more than a fiancé. He was the loyal supporter who saw her through kidney failure, dialysis, a stroke, and bariatric surgery. And even though he died earlier this month, a part of him remains with her for life. Mr. Wood died June 4th at age 46 as a result of a traumatic brain injury. 2 days later, one of his kidneys was transplanted into Fisher. She'll need to take medication for the rest of her life to keep her body from rejecting her new kidney, but the transplant means she is free of dialysis treatments for the first time in 5 years. Still, she said, I'd rather have him. The 45-year-old Fisher of Rantoul said she and Mr. Wood first met when they were in sixth grade at Champaign's Edison Middle School and went their separate ways after high school. She was already in declining health when they reconnected in 2012 and went on to spend the next 7.5 years together. Diagnosed first with high blood pressure, Fisher said she developed kidney failure and had to begin dialysis treatments in 2014. For 10.5 hours a night, she underwent dialysis at home, starting her treatments at 6 p.m. so she could be up on time in the morning to go to work at the Hampton Inn in Urbana. A mother of two daughters, Fisher also had suffered gestational diabetes with her pregnancies and had a stroke in 2017. Last year, she underwent bariatric surgery to help her lose enough weight to make it onto the kidney transplant waiting list. Mr. Wood was with her every step of the way, helping her with her medicine and her dialysis machine, checking her blood pressure and sitting with her in the hospital. I often sit and wonder what my life is going to be like without him. Fisher said she and her fiancé shared the same blood type, and it was Mr. Wood's daughter who made the decision for him to be an organ donor as he was dying in the hospital. I feel like it was a tragic miracle that we were a perfect match. She underwent her transplant surgery at OSF St. Francis Medical Center in Peoria and was discharged from the hospital last Tuesday. Mr. Wood's donated organs saved more lives than hers, and she hopes to one day meet the other people who received his organs. I'm sad because I miss him, but I am blessed because I have him with me all the time now. Also from Champaign, the soul of the Twin Cities, veteran and businessman co-founded Community's first all-black radio station. At the time, there wasn't another radio station like it anywhere east of the Mississippi. African-American owned, operated, giving voice to the local black community. WBCP 1580 AM, aka the Soul of the Twin Cities, was launched in 1989 and named after the initials of its three founders, J.W. Pirtle, Vernon Barkstall, and Lonnie Clark. Minority people in the Champaign County haven't had something they can really put their hands on and say, this is a part of our community, and yet they can do that with WBCP because it's been here for 28 years, Pirtle said upon his retirement last year. Mr. Pirtle, the station's last surviving founder, died Saturday at his home. He was 87. Much more than a media pioneer, Mr. Pirtle played baseball in the Negro Leagues, served in the Korean War, sat on the Champaign City Council, owned a gas station for 8 years, and at times ran a cab company and a restaurant and bar. But he was probably best known locally for helping launch a historic radio station, converting it from a country western music format to one of urban contemporary music and gospel. Carletta Donaldson had family connections with the Pirtles, but got to know him best as an intern at WBCP. She still sells ads on contract. His drive, his initiative to go ahead with the station and keep it together 30 years, that really says a lot about him. Mike Hale, vice president of the News Gazette Media and general manager of WDWS and WKIO, was also a close friend. I was very blessed to have the opportunity to be a sounding board for him. His vision for wanting to have an African-American radio station was so important. He could have walked away from it. He could have cashed it in. But he didn't. He continued to provide a great service for this community. Some of that was personal sacrifice, Hale added. He and Lonnie and Vern were a great trio that put a lot of their own money into this to make it fly. Donaldson also noted American Legion Post 559 Salute Our Veterans event in May singled out Mr. Pirtle for his Korean War service. The former city council member has a street named in his honor, a section of the North Fourth between East Tremont and East Grove, west of Douglas Park. In that area, Mr. Pirtle had owned several businesses. I would say radio is probably my favorite one. Second in line is the Central Cab Company, he once told the News Gazette. I like music. With his long experience in business, Mr. Pirtle mentored Sion Williams of Williams Memorial Services. When Williams decided to open a barbershop, Mr. Pirtle told him, Sion, we'll get you into business. That's what started our friendship, and he's been a big, big part of my life. The mentorship continued even to this month at Sam's Cafe in downtown Champaign, Mr. Pirtle's breakfast spot of choice. We had breakfast, and he insisted on paying my bill, Williams said. He was stern, warm-hearted. He was a wealth of information about the city of Champaign and the African-American community. As of Sunday, funeral arrangements remain incomplete. Going to where service is needed, from Urbana. Not new, just formalized. After a board vote this week on an operations agreement, that could be the status of the partnership between the Urbana School District and Champaign County Youth Assessment Center. Although the YAC has long offered its services to those in the district, the agreement formalizes the two groups' relationship and establishes responsibilities on both sides. Establishing that formality has been a goal of Jonathan Westfield since he assumed the YAC's directorship 2 years ago. What it does is that the operations agreement will be a better exchange of information between both parties that will give the staff the ability to come into the school and meet with people there and do more support and wrap around as opposed to pulling kids out. We know that if a child is in school, better that we go over where they are than to take them out. Although anyone can refer at-risk youth age 10 to 17 to the assessment center, which then has case managers screen individuals to determine what kind of resources are needed, the follow-up to that referral typically happens on-site, meaning families were responsible for providing transportation. A lot of times it's difficult for families to get their children to services, and a lot of times they don't make it to an appointment, said Urbana's Director of Grant-Based Programs, Linda Gibbons. The operations agreement, if approved, sends case managers into the school, streamlining communication between individuals served and school officials and easing the burden of families who otherwise would have had to find a way to the center's Champaign location. It's a real convenience for our families and our students. Westfield noted that early intervention compromises much of the services YAC will provide. Gibbons said the case managers complement additional mental health staffers the district hired earlier in the school year. I think this opens up the possibility of services. We've put a lot of mental health services in our buildings this past school year, and while that has been good, some needs are more intensive. This gives a connection to those services and to their experts, too. Designated district staff will keep in touch with YAC case managers and the students they serve. The lines of communication are open and would be better. Urbana School Board members will vote Tuesday whether to approve the agreement, which comes at no additional costs for the district. Also on the front page, Strokes of Genius, from Ebert to Hefner to Sandberg exhibit will feature writers with U of I ties from Champaign. Hugh Hefner was many things, millionaire, publisher, celebrity, and of course, playboy. But at heart, he was a writer and editor, his daughter says. When he was in grammar school in Chicago, Hefner published a neighborhood newspaper. In high school, he started a comic strip about his life. And before launching his Playboy publishing empire, he created a humor magazine called Shaft at the University of Illinois. The old black Underwood standard portable typewriter that Hefner used in college and later at Playboy will be featured in an exhibit on writers' tools that opens today at the U of I's Rare Book and Manuscript Library. Writers and their tools, parchment paper processors, which runs through August 30th, will include typewriters used by movie critic Roger Ebert, writer Carl Sandburg, and novelist James Jones. Christy Hefner, who will attend an opening reception for the exhibit today, thinks her father would be pleased, especially since both Ebert and Jones were published in Playboy. "He really loved being an editor," she said in a recent interview. "I think the fact that he kept this typewriter all those years is kind of astonishing. And this particular item, as opposed to his pipe or smoking jacket, he would have loved that." Hefner's typewriter is on loan from Mark Pepitone, a collector who met Christy Hefner at the auction of her father's estate last winter. Pepitone also has typewriters used by Ernest Hemingway, Maya Angelou, Tennessee Williams, and Orson Welles, and the one John Lennon used to write the lyrics for Imagine. He paid $162,000 for Hugh Hefner's typewriter. Pepitone later contacted the U of I about lending it to the university for some kind of display. Around the same time, U of I library staff members, who were sorting through objects in their archival collections, including board games and stuffed animals, came across typewriters used by Sandberg and Jones, said visiting curator Ruth Ann Miller. In all, six typewriters will be on display, including one with Yiddish characters on the keys, who curated the exhibit. It will also include a signed copy of the home front memo Sandberg wrote on his Corona silent typewriter, as well as manuscript pages and a photo of Sandberg at the typewriter. The library has two typewriters that belong to Jones, including an electric version that looks more like an early computer. The exhibit will include a manuscript of his novel From Here to Eternity and a copy of A Soldier's Daughter Never Cries, his daughter's semi-autobiographical account of the family's time in Paris. Besides the typewriter used by Ebert, which is also on loan, the exhibit will feature his first byline article in the Daily Illini and the first issue he published as editor-in-chief. Alongside Hefner's typewriter will be a copy of Shaft and the first issue of Playboy. The exhibit also includes parchment paper, quill pens, and an ink pot, printing plates, and a metal type from a printing press, and a computer hard drive. There's a lot of history there. They are beautiful objects, and they are sort of this way of looking at how things used to be done. When she learned about the exhibit, Christy Hefner decided to attend the opening with her mother, Millie Williams, who is Hugh Hefner's first wife and a U of I graduate. As convenient in all senses of the word that computers are in our lives, there's a kind of character about typewriters that you feel connected in some way to the user. A celebrity roast Christy Hefner organized for Playboy's 25th anniversary in 1979 in New York's Tavern on the Green featured typewriters spray-painted silver on the tables. It was the first fundraiser for the Student Fellowships in Journalism at the U of I in Hugh Hefner's name. I know he had enormous positive feelings about his time in college and at the university. Hugh Hefner enrolled at the U of I in 1946 as a psychology student and graduated early in 1949 with a degree in psychology and a double minor in creative writing and art. Leading American playwright Samuel Ralphison, author of The Jazz Singer, had a huge influence on Hefner, who took one of his courses. The two remained friends for life. Working with a renowned published writer who took an interest in my dad was really influential in kind of encouraging him to follow his dreams. When Hugh Hefner died in 2017, he left all of his personal belongings to the foundation he created in 1964, everything from the typewriter to his first copy of Playboy to his famous slippers and smoking jacket, with instructions to auction them off and use the proceeds to fund its work to protect civil rights and civil liberties, particularly the First Amendment. The auction raised $3 million. I think it was just for Hef, a cornerstone of all of our other freedoms in this democracy, Christy Hefner said of the First Amendment. It's how you argue for your point of view. It's how you promote social change. It's how you cause social change without violence. So it was a really deeply held principle of his and was certainly a pillar of the Playboy Foundation and then as a successor, a pillar of the Hugh Hefner Foundation. She too loved writing from an early age and worked as a journalist at the Boston Phoenix for a year after graduating from Brandeis University in 1974. She had dreams of being the next Ella Goodman, a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist who could write about big issues but in a personal voice. Christy Hefner soon realized only a tiny, tiny percentage of journalists get to do that. She decided to apply to Yale for law school and a graduate program in public policy with a new dream of serving in the U.S. Senate or on the Supreme Court. But her father, who had recently moved to Los Angeles, asked her to move back to Chicago to learn more about his company. She agreed, thinking it might be like a junior year abroad, and then I'd go on with my life. I had no idea that I'd end up staying and running the company. What was it like working with Hef? It didn't hurt that he lived in L.A. and I lived in Chicago, she said. His primary interests were really on the creative side, and mine were more on the business and strategy side. She said she knew some people thought she had the position only because of family ties, but feels that most judged her based on what I did with the opportunity. The people who couldn't get past the fact that my last name was Hefner were ultimately people whose opinions didn't matter to me. In this Me Too era, Christy Hefner, a feminist who champions progressive politics, makes no apologies for Playboy. She has said that 80% of the people who worked for Playboy were feminists, and that its products appealed to both men and women, and that hers was a generation that embraced its sexuality with the advent of birth control and women's rights after years of repression. I've tried to live the magazine's philosophy that men can both desire and admire women, and women want to be both treated seriously and be sexy, whether that's in a gay or straight relationship, as do men. Hefner is proud that having run an enterprise that was unabashedly sexy in its approach and attitude, we did not have a problem of harassment in the company. It just underscored something I've long believed. The issue is an abuse of power, just as sexual assault is a crime of violence and not sex. She's also proud that Playboy recognized the potential of the internet and multimedia early on as the first national magazine to create a content website to complement its other products in 1994. That said, she knows the digital landscape has changed dramatically since she left Playboy Enterprises 10 years ago, when social media barely existed. Companies now need to constantly reinvent themselves. Netflix started by disrupting Blockbuster in the delivery of DVDs, then disrupted itself with streaming. She is now a business strategist, working both as a board member for Hatch Beauty Brands and other companies, but also directly with CEOs, including actor Jim Belushi, brother of the late John Belushi, who is involved in the cannabis industry. He believes passionately that his brother would be alive today if he had been able to treat mental health issues with cannabis instead of opioids. She also advises Forum Communications, a Fargo-based media company that owns 30 newspapers. To survive the disruption of the internet, newspapers need to invest in compelling content and technology. I don't think it's surprising that companies like the Washington Post are doing well, not just because they're owned by a billionaire. That billionaire is putting technology in the service of great journalism. She also works with the Center for American Progress think tank, the 270 Project, and Springboard, a nonprofit supporting women tech entrepreneurs. She believes there should be some kind of regulatory framework that recognizes the world of social media is a different world, but it should be crafted with an eye toward not violating the First Amendment. Hefner, who sat on the ACLU's board for many years, thinks it will have to be a collaborative effort between government regulators and civil liberties advocates. It won't be easy, she said, but I think it's probably not going to be sufficient to look to the Facebooks and Googles of the world to say, hey, regulate yourselves. And from Peoria, court hears what killer said at vigil. Defendant had brief visit with his father while being brought in last Friday. While Ying Ying Zhang's family was trying to raise awareness for her disappearance at a campus vigil, Brett Christensen was drinking alcohol from a water bottle, cracking jokes, and bragging about how gruesomely he killed her. Even his lawyer, Assistant Federal Defender Elizabeth Pollock, called it a deeply disturbing recording, which his girlfriend recorded with a body microphone while acting as a paid informant for the FBI. A night you'll remember, Christensen told his girlfriend in the recording, which was played for the first time Friday during the third day of his trial. All those people here tonight, they want her home safe. They have no idea what happened. I'm the only one, he said, starting to open up to his girlfriend before eventually describing in gruesome detail how he claimed he killed Miss Zhang. Less than 20 feet away, Miss Zhang's family looked toward a TV screen set up for the audience to follow along and listen to a translation through an earpiece, hearing Christensen describe in his own words how he killed their daughter, sister, and girlfriend. As the more than hour-long recording was played, Christensen didn't appear to have much of a reaction, either looking down or at the screen ahead of him, which scrolled through a transcript of what he was saying. Christensen hasn't shown much outward emotion throughout this whole process, hardly saying a word at his various pretrial hearings, briefly chatting with his court-appointed lawyers before proceedings begin each day, and sometimes eating yogurt or a granola bar during a break. But on Friday, his face lit up during a break when he was brought in and saw his dad standing near the railing separating the public from the court. "Hi, Dad," Christensen said. "Hi," his dad responded. "How's it going?" "I'm good," his dad said. "Me too." "Be strong," his dad said. After the brief conversation, he returned to his seat, and the proceedings soon resumed. In the afternoon, FBI Specialist Agent Andrew Huckstadt described how they signed Christensen's girlfriend up to be a confidential source a week after Miss Zhang was abducted June 9, 2017. From June 16th to June 29th, she recorded 9 conversations, 2 phone calls, and 7 in person. The defendant was under surveillance around the clock at this point. Initially, the local FBI agents were conducting surveillance on their own, but eventually brought on professionals who were more covert and used aerial surveillance. After his girlfriend recorded a conversation, Hochstead would usually immediately retrieve the body microphone, download the recording, and return the microphone to her. During the first conversation, June 16th, he told his girlfriend he loved her before going to bed. "Sweet dreams, Bunny, my kitten," he said, using her pet name. The next day, he talked with her on her porch, as her roommates wouldn't let him in their house. Christensen told her he was trying to clear my name and just trying to cooperate. "I'm still free," he told her, before pointing out a surveillance vehicle down the road. "It's obvious," he said, amused. "I'm not doing anything wrong. They can follow me all they want. We've experienced something that not many people have. It's weird." Huckstadt said the surveillance vehicle was visible because they were concerned about the safety of his girlfriend. 3 days later, he assured her it's going to be okay. But his girlfriend asked about the 6-foot duffel bag he had purchased. He claimed it was used for transport a present for her, which broke, so he discarded the bag. "I don't know where the duffel is," he said. "It's suspicious looking, I acknowledge. Someone might have taken it or something." His girlfriend doubted that, saying, "People don't steal stuff around here." Christensen knew the FBI knew about the duffel bag because his wife had talked to them. "She told them everything about me, and that scares me," he said, but he insisted they're searching for something that doesn't exist. 2 days before the campus vigil, Christensen told his girlfriend he was particularly concerned about the FBI announcing that his Saturn Astra had been located. He tried to give his girlfriend an explanation for why the FBI would do that if he's not the suspect. And he complained about not being able to retrieve items seized by the FBI in their search of his apartment, including his camera and shoes. The next recording was made at the campus vigil. When she started her recording, Christensen's girlfriend noted the absurdity of Christensen attending and drinking at an event for a person he was suspected of killing. "This is kind of ridiculous," she said before meeting up with Christensen. They chatted about alcohol, with Christensen noting that Mike's Hard Lemonade is like the greatest thing of all time. "I'm not ashamed to say that I love girly drinks," he said at the campus vigil. When they saw how many people were there, Christensen said it was more than he expected. "I just wanted to see how many people were here. They're here for me." After the event, he walked toward his home with his girlfriend, and she lightly taunted him about being scared to tell her what happened to Miss Zhang. He apparently began bragging about previous abductions he's made. His girlfriend joked about how she felt safer with Christensen than taking an Uber home. "My version of safer is walking at night with a serial killer," she said. "Yeah, that's me," Christensen said, just before describing how he killed Miss Zhang. She was valiant, he said, more than any of his other alleged victims. She fought more than anyone else. Asked when he'll have enough victims, he said, I still want to do it. It's just my legacy. He claimed his murder of Miss Zhang was the only one where he left evidence that leads back to him. After he took her to his apartment, Christensen claimed he tore her clothes off and just started doing stuff to her, but got bored and just didn't care. They have the bat I hit her in the head with, he said. I tried to choke her to death, but she just didn't die. It must have been 10 minutes with my hands, then I released her. I couldn't believe she was still alive. I carried her into my bathtub, got the bat, and hit her on the head as hard as I could. He wasn't sure if he'd killed her, so I had a knife, and I stabbed her in the neck, and she grabbed for it. He said that's what killed her, and then I chopped her head off, and that was the end of it. Christensen marveled about being the only person who knew about this. I've wanted to talk about this with someone so much. He bragged that Miss Zhang was his 13th victim, but assured his girlfriend she wouldn't be next because she was too big. It's about getting rid of 100 pounds versus 150 pounds, too much to get rid of. He bragged about getting the nation's attention. I didn't want to, but I still did. He claimed to live a double life like the main character of his favorite book, American Psycho, and boasted that he is the most successful person who has done this in the past 30 years. As they continued walking, he sounded amused about the campus vigil. They thanked me for being there. It's so weird. But he insisted he would never tell anyone where to look for Miss Zhang. I won't tell you where she is. I won't tell anyone. They will never find her. Miss Zhang's family is going to leave empty-handed, he boasted. No one will ever know where she is. She's gone forever. Also Friday, the prosecution continued to detail their search for Miss Zhang. FBI agent Michael Cardner said they searched in abandoned properties, along railroad tracks and drainage pipes, and near bridges. He said the search continued well into 2018, with a search along the shoreline at Clinton Lake in November 2017, and another of the burn pits and wooded areas at Allerton Park in 2018. Assistant U.S. Attorney Byron Frears asked Carter if they found Miss Zhang. No, we did not, Carter said. Friday's proceedings moved a little slower than previous days with another motion by the defense for a mistrial that was denied, some technical difficulties with the recordings of numerous objections and sidebars, where the lawyers huddled with the judge away from earshot. The day wrapped up around 4:30 later than U.S. District Judge James Shandid had anticipated. The trial will resume today with Pollack's cross-examination of Hochstadt. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, June 17th. Please stay tuned.